Hi, Ryan.
Hello, Rachel.
How you doing?
Do you ever, when you're speaking into these microphones when we record, do you ever just feel like God when you do it?
No, but I have been wondering about, like, where do our listeners fit into our lives? What's the purpose and how do they fit into the grand scheme
of
things?
Well, that's quite interesting. You see, I've made a chart here. I based it on the Ottoman Empire, actually. So you and I are not the heart. It's actually Commander Nandi. She's the heart because she said yum yum in Star Trek Discovery. And then we're above it, and the yumlings are actually... You think I'm going to say below or above? No, they're to the right because they're right
okay.
to listen to us.
Yes.
Over any other podcast. And here's a picture of my mum and dad. Quite a nice photo. They don't fit in here, but it's just nice photo. Oh.
Hey, they do fit in because
they gave birth to me. Both of them together.
No, not that. Not that. I didn't think we were going to bring that up. Like, I know we talk spoilers, but about Babylon 5.
Yeah.
Not about your life. No.
Did you know I saved a baby one time? I don't know if I've ever brought it up on the podcast before. It's worth a 5-star review just because I've said that. I don't need to clarify any further. But we should clarify on some things. We're yum
can
yum. Oh, yes, yes. Continue the train. Choo choo.
I was just going to say, but they are responsible for giving you Babylon 5.
They're to blame. Mum, Dad, you're to blame for this podcast, so there you are. So we're Ryan and Rachel, your hosts of Yum Yum 5 of the Yum Yum podcast. Yum Yum is a phrase that was uttered by an entity in Star Trek Discovery, a show that we also do cover episode by episode. We are a rewatch podcast, so we look at things from a perspective of revisiting a show and picking up on the little details we may have missed on previous watches. So that does mean spoilers. We're here to talk about Babylon 5, a show that is very near and dear to us, and we always say that you guys listening out there should watch the show. Even if you've seen it before, you should give the episodes that we're talking about a look over again so that you can notice some little details too, in case we've missed them. Or when we bring it up, you can be like, oh yeah, I didn't think about that. So we are here to look at and talk about today a part of a trilogy, in a way of speaking. I don't think it's an official, it's not part one, part two, part three, but we are at the beginning of what I think they call the Severed Dreams trilogy. We've got episode 8, Messages from Earth. I've got the DVD description, and again, can we all thank my parents? They got the DVDs. They got the DVDs, and I got to read those booklets as a little boy and get inspired by them because they have such amazing prose as such. The secret alliance initiated by Sheridan is already enough to bring charges of treason. Now, the captain ups the ante by setting out to destroy a recently discovered shadow vessel before it becomes fully operational.
Dun, dun, dun!
Who would have said yum yum in this episode? Who had YYE?
Well, Lanier was bringing a little YYE.
You know he's bringing YYE when they call him Mr. Lanier. Because he's got so much, they have to refer to him as a Mr. No longer just Lanier. Is that your candidate?
Yeah. There are other characters that are also bringing YYE, but I want to hear your suggestion.
Marcus is always a contender, but to me, he was restrained enough in portions here to not be YYE all the time. But when he was, he really was.
He could have bought YYE by
He bought it with some British pounds? Do you think they still have pennies? In Babylon 5 time, do you like the English are the only ones who don't use credits? They're still on pounds and pennies?
I don't know, but I was going to say that
in that he was rather reserved for Marcus.
Yeah.
When he was having that scene with Franklin.
Oh, and like, with Ivanova too, there was some reserved quality. My candidate is Lanier as well. He really leapt out to me as the person who would have said yum yum uncharacteristically, but in a way where it would have slotted in. I do want to give a shout out though to somebody who I am surprised we don't give YYE to often enough, Garibaldi. He opens up the episode bitching about this gruelish food that they eat all the time, and he might as well have just grabbed a microphone and just said, guys, listen to my comedy set today, because I've got a whole bit about food. But then Sheridan and Ivanova outdo him in YYE in that moment.
Shut up and eat it.
This station's just full of jokers.
But where in my contract does it say that I have to eat the same food for breakfast every day for 3 years?
Paragraph 47, subsection 19, clause 9A. You can find it in the index under SUAEI.
SUAEI?
Shut up and eat it.
History and relationship with this one for me is quite obvious. It's a great episode. I've enjoyed it. When I first saw it, I was floored and exhilarated and excited by all of the moving parts towards these bigger plays happening, with the revelation of the shadows burying themselves underneath the ground on Mars and planting themselves like seeds is something that stuck with me from that initial watch to this right now. Whenever I think of what really unsettles me about the shadows, it's that image of them on Mars. And I was biting at the bit to see how the crew of Babylon 5 were going to deal with Earth and how they're ramping up their power and their corruption with the Night Watch on the station and with what Clark and co. were doing off station with the shadow ships, and then eventually martial law at the end. Those are the things that really struck me when I first viewed it. But when I look back at this, what really is the thing that I take away is that beautiful scene, possibly one of my favorite written pieces of work that JMS has ever done, which is the conversation Sheridan and Delenn have about his need to go to sleep and the rain on the roof, and we'll talk about it as we go along. But when I think of Messages from Earth, I think about that beautiful speech that he gives about his dad, and it's just one of those great performances as well from both Mira and Bruce.
You're like, I miss your dad too.
I miss your dad and I've never met him. I will later, but yeah, there's just a lot here. What about you?
Oh my God, this episode is so much in the best possible ways. And I remember being really excited and really scared watching it the first time, because you have no idea what it's going to cost them to do this. You're told that it's a suicide mission and you're like, well, I don't know. I don't think either of them will die. I think they'll get out of it okay, but you know that there's going to be some cost and you don't know what kind or how much that's going to be, and that tension is still ripe. It doesn't get nerfed by the fact that you're like, oh, they're not going to kill off two main characters, because for one, you're like, well, maybe they will.
Yes.
Maybe they will. I don't know.
We've already lost Kefa. We've already lost Kef.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tears are rolling down Rachel's face as I said the name. R.I.P. Kef, short for Kefa. But you were saying that there was a real sense of danger and excitement presented here.
Yeah, because it's weird, because it's just like, as the Shadow War is beginning to unfold and we're learning the truth about the universe, it's like, and Delenn's like, now is not the time, now is not the time, now is not the time. And you're kind of like, okay, they're biding their time. They've got reasons for why they're doing it this way. They're slowly going out on these missions with the White Star, trying to find the first ones. All of this stuff is going along.
Mm. We've been promised in the show that now that we have the White Star and Earth is ramping itself up, we're no longer going to sit on Babylon 5 and wait for things to come to us.
The War Council is a thing.
Yeah.
Even though it isn't an open war yet. So I was like, okay, wait, you're actually going to go after Earth?
Mm.
And that's beyond the comfort zone in lots of different ways, because it feels very different when they're fighting other people. But going against EarthGov, and with each subsequent viewing, when Sheridan takes off his Earth Force badge.
And then his uniform as well.
And then the badge is the scene that really gets me. Mm. Because, the regret and the way that Bruce just acts his bloody heart out without saying a word in that scene, the regret, but the determination that he has of, this doesn't mean what it used to mean to me. And I feel like that's the core of it for me. That scene is sort of the duck's eye.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
All the Lynch fans know. I
forget that that's
a thing. What you're talking about, though, there is with the relinquishing of the badge, then fighting Earth. I was thinking about this when I was editing and putting together our discussion about Voices of Authority, about Julie Masanti as a character and how she is...
terrifying?
No. Yes, she is, but how we as the audience didn't realize that she was going to be the last of a certain kind of thing we had in the show regularly, which is the evil, corrupt Earth figure that comes aboard the station and our crew has to smile politely at them, treat them with courtesy, but figure out a way to foil them or get them off the station because they're a threat, they're an adversary, and they have to play within the rules. This is very much that, where we, when we are first watching this, don't realize that this is going to be a closing of the book, these series of episodes to come, a closing of the book of a part of the show that we lived in, which is them being a part of Earth and the government. Because
the Avalanche has begun.
Yes, this is the episode where it's beginning. They're taking a ship and they're flying directly into Earth territory and fighting them and taking things down. There's obviously things that are still yet to come, of course, and Sheridan has some lines that he's not willing to cross yet. But this really is, with him taking off the badge, that's it. This is the end of this is the beginning of an end of an era. And we, the audience, don't know that yet. And even upon rewatches, it still creeps up on you because you know that the Point of No Return and Severed Dream episodes are coming up, but still there's this sense of, wow, really coming to this, huh? And you see that in multitude of ways in the episode with people like what's going on with Zach, as well as what's going on with Sheridan and Delenn and Garibaldi and all of them. I want to touch upon a small aspect of the episode first, which is Jakar. He's in a singular scene.
Oh, boy!
But I want to just mention him because it was a beautiful scene. A lot of this, pretty much most of the scenes in this are really beautiful. We've gone from that JMS quirky humor of Voices of Authority, that weirdness of Exogenesis, to here where a lot of the scenes are dripping with that sincerity and warmth. And also sadness and melancholy, but also enlightened beauty that JMS is really good at bringing out in characters. And you get this with Jakar. And what is a real thing to think about with this Jakar scene, Rachel, we've talked about this a lot over the course of this podcast, which is a lot of times now in modern television, especially with something like Star Trek Discovery or Star Trek Picard, is you spend a whole episode and you go, what was the episode? Because all we did was maintain and keep up to date and water the seeds of all of these storylines we've got going on instead of telling an episode, like telling a story within an episode. And the Jakar scene here is a great miniature example of that, where he does not have a plot here. He does not do anything here. All it is there to do is to keep you up to date with where Jakar is at and to show you that he is changing. That's it. It's for building up.
Yep.
It's setting things up like his book, but in the terms of this 45 minutes, it doesn't contribute anything here.
No.
And I wanted to point that out because although it doesn't contribute anything in this moment, in this episode, it will further down the line, but it doesn't slow down the momentum or the importance of the others, because it is one small thing instead of the episode being built upon all of these kind of maintenance of overarching plots, because that's what B5 is really good at. You look at it and you go, the series as a whole has who knows how many characters when you add it all up, all with, like, let's be generous and say four different plot lines to each of them going on at any given time. And we still manage to, for the most part, maintain the spinning of the plates and still be able to watch an episode and go, this is the episode where Earth has a shadow ship. That's what it's about. While still also going, oh, but there is that scene with Jakar where they're setting up the Book of Jakar.
This is not the kind of show where only one thing is happening in the entire world at a time.
But the writing doesn't lose focus on what we are here for. We are not here to spend 45 minutes watching the writing staff keep watering the seeds of all of these storylines and not actually giving us a story in the episode we're here to watch. I just wanted to point that out. Now, with the Jakar stuff, what did you think of it? It's been a couple of episodes since we've seen him. And here he is, he's in prison and he's talking to, his good dear friend, Mr. Garibaldi. Do you want to walk us through it and what you thought?
I cannot get over the visual direction in this scene. Like, Andreas always brings his fucking A game. He is milking every beautiful line that he is given to its last drop while making it feel and seem completely effortless to do so. I was just in awe of him while watching this scene, and I love the way that they use the shadows in this scene.
The lighting is particularly great and it complements the angular nature of his makeup and his face naturally. It gives him a mischievous quality a little bit when he sinks back into the shadows and says something along the lines of, you know, basically, maybe later when it's, can I read your book? Another time. And he has that wicked smile of his. We, going over Babylon 5, JMS is really great at writing this very flowery and poetic and elegant dialogue. To our taste, it rarely ever pushes over the line of being too pretentious. And it's because there are certain characters and certain actors who, when you put it in their mouth, it comes out right. And Jakar,
it feels right.
Jakar here, the way he's speaking throughout the entire sequence, where he's just casually dropping these amazing moments of prose and belief and awakening, and because it's Jakar, and because that character, even at his lowest points in terms of when he was more villainous, always had a more refined Shakespearean-esque quality about him, it feels right. And Andreas Kotsoulis as an actor can make these lines work really well. But I really like that we get, outside of the scene being Jakar is becoming more attuned with himself as a person. He in this cell is finding who he is, because when you're out in the world, it is there to distract you from yourself. Here, you cannot be distracted. That is great, but what I really liked is the rapport between Garibaldi and Jakar. They have little moments of sweetness, tenderness, and humor where they have the whole back and forth about how Jakar is singing in his cell and they're making a petition. And you're smiling as I say this because that's just a nice piece of business. Does that piece of business about him singing, people making a petition, or for or against, is that the meat of the scene? No, but it is a part of the scene that I remember so fondly because it is just a nice piece of humanity there. Yeah. Where we just talk like that, you know, like, oh, you're singing. Oh, yeah, we all hear about it. It's just a nice piece of work.
Oh, it also ties back to things that Londo has said of, like,
non-singing is horrible.
Non-singing is horrible. Non-opera is horrible. And when the techno mage gives him, like, that
the curse,
and it's playing non-music and non-singing.
Mm-hmm. What did you think about Jakar's book that he's writing and his overall... He makes this comment in reference to his singing, but the overall statement of an artist is never really appreciated in their own lifetime.
It's a very common saying, and there is a lot of truth to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think more so in the past, I feel like in more modern eras, we have gotten better at appreciating people when they're still around.
Yeah, JMS, are you listening to this podcast? Buddy? Buddy or pal of mine? My fellow Polish man? Are you listening? Better be.
In here, Mr. Garibaldi, you cannot hide from yourself. Everything out there has only one purpose: to distract us from ourselves, from what is truly important. But there are no distractions in here. You can learn much from silence.
I really understand and appreciate where Jakar is coming from when he says that. And I love the sort of dramatic irony of that statement for Jakar, because he cannot fucking deal when he is appreciated in his own lifetime.
Well, he isn't, though, is he? Because they misconstrue his work. Like, he's appreciated in terms of fame.
He's acknowledged.
Popularity.
But...
but they don't appreciate what his artistry and what his wisdom is. They misconstrue it. They want it for their own purposes. And eventually, he has to fucking leave so that society can maintain itself for the nun. Because if he stays, it will just spin out of control and he himself will become influenced by it. And I really forgot that moment happened here. Like, I remember he's beginning to write his book, but I didn't remember that the inception of his book being brought into the show is paired with that statement. JMS, if we look at it in terms of how much he sets up and pays off in the show, he's setting up here that he's going to write his own holy book. And he's also saying in this moment, with the setup of this here, that it will be spun out of control and it will not be appreciated in his lifetime.
Yep.
Beautiful stuff. I just wanted to mention that because also it's Jakar. Anytime Jakar is in a scene, even if it's one, you got to talk about the man because he is such a fascinating character. We've gone so far since The Gathering, haven't we? Where he was fascinating in terms of how over the top and silly he was. Here, he's much more reserved and quiet, and you hang on every word he says.
He's not concerned with being heard. He's concerned with having the right thing to say.
I've got some news about Marcus. I'm a fan of Marcus again. I have been off him on the rewatch, even though I like the dude and I think Jason Carter is a great performer, I'm happy to announce that I saw the things that I like in the character in this episode that have been lacking in those previous. And it makes sense. This is a new character. JMS is creating him, forming him, developing him. So there's that period of time where you're not too sure as a viewer and you need yourself to become more used to the figure. But to me, in this episode, it is crystal clear that JMS and Jason Carter find an avenue for the character of Marcus that will be more explored as we go along, which is he has that scene with Ivanova where Ivanova is angry at him because she has no one else to take it out on, because the scenario happening around them is too much for her to handle, where they have to fight their own people. The shadows are here. There's no way to win. And he is there and she doesn't know how he fits. She needs things to fit into place. That's Ivanova. She needs everyone to listen to her because she's right. And she can't make the world right. And Marcus is just a small example of that, of, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you do. In terms of in relation to me, am I your superior? Are we equals? Are you below me? Like, are you above me? Like, who are you? But I really liked his back and forth in that particular scene. Before, like, after he was silly with the whole, oh, my nose is on fire and I've got ferrets in my trousers or all of that crap.
Yep.
The typical Marcus.
Would you prefer ferrets?
Would you prefer ferrets? His typical, oh, I'm ever so British and quirky. I'm not like the other boys. Crap. His Jason Carter's performance really captures a quiet nobility and wisdom and empathy, restrained. That is the Marcus I really like. And it does mainly work because it is a contrast to his much more loud, boisterous, over-the-top, blabbermouthy side, but I really liked him in that in a good portion of the episode, especially this scene. How did you feel about the rapport between Marcus and Ivanova during this episode? Because they're definitely leaning into these two being together more, more flirtatious energies happening here. But what did you think about
him? Because he's now openly said that he's interested in her. And he's, you know, they've had the roses incident and now they have the bacon and eggs thing.
Yeah.
I love the way that she's like, I'm going to kill him. Mm-hmm. If I can find him, I'm going to kill him.
But I'm going to eat first.
Yep. And doesn't offer them any.
She tries to palm it off and they're like, no. Watch.
Yeah. She's like, oh, I'll give it to you two. You two can share. And then they're like, no, we'll watch. She's just like, okay, well, I'm going to tuck in by myself. No, I'm going to divide this three ways.
No.
Either you two can have it or I can have it. I just really enjoyed that scene that doesn't even have Marcus in it, but then like,
it's his effect upon her.
Yeah. It crashes into the scene with Marcus.
She annoyed him. He annoyed her, but also brightened up her day and made her smile. Which is what he's all about. But you were saying in overall, though, you're a big Marcus and Ivanova fan. How have you been feeling about Marcus thus far on the rewatch? You've said you've enjoyed his annoying qualities, but are you like me? Did you kind of see there's a bit of a shift here, or a bit of a layer has been peeled back a bit?
I'm officially in love with Marcus again. I don't just like Marcus. I love Marcus again. Like, I think that's the difference for me.
And what has pushed it for you now for love?
How big his heart is. Like, his determination to save and protect this woman and to make Ivanova smile. Mm-hmm. Like, he's a jackass with a heart, and I'm a sucker for those.
Yeah, that's why you married me, right?
Yep.
But I'm not a jackass, right? I'm just your No, average guy who likes yum yum. And
you are an asshole.
That's the difference. I'm an asshole. You like the you do like the whole package of Marcus. Well, even though I am a fan of the character, I do find the JMS dialogue to be a little too wrought for my taste. But it is easing back, and it is not just because I'm becoming more comfortable. It's he is allowing in his own writing and for the performer to be more quiet in scenes. Not saying he's not saying dialogue more or less. It's that
he's not proclaiming, I am here and I am character. Hear me roar.
Yes.
It's like, I am this person. I will continue to be this person in your face.
He is an avenue for a character like Ivanova, who is very internal and emotionally restrictive, to express and open themselves up, even if it is with a flurry of rage like she has, or if it is to have a giggle about something really silly. And they are, as we know, the future of the show, going to be pushing Ivanova and Marcus towards some romantic entanglements. But even outside of that, Marcus's role here is to help Ivanova loosen up a little bit in a way that someone like Sheridan and someone like Garibaldi can't do. As we see from the opening scene, they help her be fun and free in their own ways, as pals, as fellow officers. While Marcus, he doesn't fit that mold, he doesn't need to. And so you have a fun thing to play with there, and I really appreciated
it's a different dynamic to bring in.
I've warmed to him more, and I'm looking forward to more stuff with Marcus, because I know there's more layers to him. We will see more and more. There's tragedy underneath all of the silliness, and there's so much to go on there. But in the early part of the show, he is very much the, hello there, I'm the British lad who makes jokes about the French and, ooh, want ooh. Some ferrets in my trousers. But here we even see that he has a little bit of a hero complex, where he thought Sheridan was going to send me because I'm the bad boy who does the fighting, and I have my stick, and I flip off walls and kick guys, and I make quips and jokes. I'm the guy who has action sequences in this show. And we have him in the Ivanova scenes. He's not allowed to be that big boy action hero that he likes to think he is. He is too romantically attracted to her, but also she puts him off kilter a lot as well. It's not just he does it to her, she does it to him as well, but in a far more subtle way in comparison, which I think is something I'm looking forward to seeing more of between the two characters.
Ever since you've come here, we've had nothing but trouble. You're a loose cannon.
He went of his own free will. He didn't have to go.
Yes, he did, and you knew he would the second he found out what was going on.
I'd rather assumed he would send me. Funny that. But if you are right, and it was inevitable, why blame me?
Because we shouldn't have to be doing this. Because he didn't have any business taking out that ship without me there to help him. Because we're going up against our own government. I don't know where the hell I fit in anymore, much less you. And damn it, because I don't have anybody else to blame.
You are aware. You are very aware that Earth is corrupt.
What? I didn't hear that. Are you sure? They've solved homelessness.
They are Earth Dome. Earth Dome is, but also interplanetary expeditions.
Oh, IPX.
A bit shady.
What? They hired Ducky from NCIS. They can't be that bad.
No.
Remember him?
Yes, I do.
Franklin should remember him. Can I just say, whoa. In this episode, they explain IPX, and Franklin goes, oh, yes. He says the slogan. He goes, yes, I've seen the ads.
That's not your connection.
That's not your connection to IPX, dude. You had a fucking university professor from there that worked with them that nearly got the station destroyed because he had a super weapon man walking around going, protect. But. The more we forget about infection,
the better
we are off. Yes, IPX, I remember those guys. They've been frequently mentioned throughout the show. And again, to just say how much my memory has been faulty on some of these little touches in B5, I'm glad that we've been podcasting this rewatch, because it's made us have to bring up those guys a lot. And I really have forgotten how much they were sprinkled throughout these first few seasons. It was throughout the show. I always remember them being in the first season. Like, they were this thing in the first season, and then they just stopped using them. But boy, but they just
keep
referring to them.
Yep, they keep on popping up.
So, you know, our shady businesses do. they're responsible for uncovering and causing mayhem.
Yeah.
I don't know what is the word for discovering.
Well, they've unleashed a darkness.
Oh yeah,
unintentionally so. Because they did what is the right thing, even for a corporation, which is, shit, this thing's scary. And what they find is on Mars, they're doing a dig, because there's always rumors that there's artifacts on Mars, which is a nice little tidbit to say, we've never found that there's been life on Mars before. Because in the sci-fi universe, there's always going to be that there are actually Martians on Mars, the ancient Martians, like in Futurama. But here, there's always been rumors. They find something, they dig it up. It's a shadow ship buried underneath the surface of Mars. Striking visual, beautiful use of CGI, the color palette of it all, the uncanny nature of seeing one of these huge black spidery ships in the dirt when we're so used to them being masters of space.
Oh, it really brings home the scale of the shadow ship.
But they do the right thing even for an evil corporation. They look at this Cthulian horror and say, shit, let's call Earth. Let's call the government. And they have to wait around and they have the story that she tells. And before we even get into the story, the direction, editing, and overall composition of everything in this sequence is a masterclass of delivering a story and exposition. In the yesteryear of this show, it would have just been a lady sitting there, and maybe you cut to some CG, but you have a nice use of fades, clever camera work, like zooming in on her mouth from profile, and it slowly fades into Mars, and her naturally like pinkish red lips blending into the color of Mars. Really creative, keeps you on your toes. The use of music and soundscape throughout this sequence is making it rise above, again, if it is just an actor saying the lines. Because this character, the Doctor character, she only exists to tell our crew what the problem of this episode is and some interesting lore. She's not a character. She doesn't do anything else. She exists in the script solely for this purpose, which is a complaint of mine. I do kind of think they should have done a little bit more with her to make it less of a scripting thing. But the execution in the actual episode makes that irrelevant to me. Would you agree?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like, yep, that's a thing, and I forgive it because it's doing all of these other things so amazingly. But if they did try and do other shit with this, it would make it worse overall. Trying to patch that issue would draw more attention away than you want to.
So she tells the story about the shadows on Mars. And what has been your reaction to this? Do you remember? Because I, as I said in my history, remember so vividly this happening when I viewed it. But what about you?
I don't remember it as distinctly. I usually forget that Garibaldi was there.
Yeah, because it's a weird little detail that I think needs to be fleshed out more like in the show.
Yeah, like it's just a little too loose thready.
Yeah, apparently so, some comic book or book gets into it, but that's not good enough.
Whatever.
We need it in the show.
Yeah. We know your stance on extracurricular reading.
Mm-hmm. I don't like reading in general. That's why when I read the DVD descriptions, I actually have Rachel just whispering it into my ear. You can't hear it because I'm really good at audio editing, but that's what's happening, okay? just for your information. But you don't remember this as strongly.
No. And then I'm always like, oh, how could I forget this scene? Because it is so well articulated and orchestrated. And I'm like, oh, yeah, this is in this episode.
And it's creepy. The shadows have planted themselves not only inside plants, but so close to Earth. And they've been there for ages and ages and ages. The fact that a human hand touching it without the glove on drains them of all their life. And the image of the other shadow ship flying overhead and cutting it out of the ground and then them flying off into the sky is a beautiful piece of work. Again, memorable imagery.
Terrifying, too.
Terrifying. The scream, the way she's describing this all playing out is, it is unsettling. And off we go to the races. We get set up with so much stuff here that we'll see play out in the show to come. The biotechnology is something we've already gotten into, so when we hear later that they need a human or a host component, we already knew this information was available to us because of an episode like Infection, where we had living weapons. And
Vorlons have organic technology. Vorlons have organic shit,
but and obviously Anna Sheridan was plugged into one of these, and we'll find that out at the end of the season. So that's putting that idea in our head as well. But what a great pitch of, that's scary enough, but they found another one, guys. Earth, you know that scary thing that we're a part of and we're
it
all...
It didn't just happen once, guys.
That we're all afraid of. They've found another ship, and this time they're not fucking around. They're going to keep it for themselves and use it as a weapon for their own means. And we, the amount of carnage that they could unleash and against who is, it's hard to measure, because they could use it against us. They could use it against the other alien races. All hell will break loose. You guys need to stop it is the episode.
Yeah.
And what a thing to just throw out there, because not only are you bringing in the ancient alien foe, but you're tying them with the human mm-hmm. foes. So now they are truly interlinked together.
This is kind of a relatively small thing, but I do want to make a point of it. I really love her performance as she's giving all of this exposition.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, at least, I don't know if you feel the same, it feels like she's rehearsed this in her head.
Oh, yeah.
She knows what she's going to say, and she is resigned to dying.
And I just want to further touch upon that point. The character has clearly rehearsed in their head, not saying
yes.
the actress.
And, oh, yeah,
and then, but that's an acting upon acting.
Yeah.
Where you have to... It's just hard to process that you as an actor have to make it come across that your character has really memorized this and worked it out without it coming across like you are just a bad actor who is having to have memorized this and making it's a layers upon layers here. And again, guest star performance only really in this scene. She's got another scene where she's running around getting attacked and whatever. But yeah, you were saying she gives a decent performance. I've always been distracted by her because she kind of looks like one of the main characters from Stargate SG-1. She just has a similar vibe and look to me. It's not, but she just looks like a character that would exist in Stargate to me.
Just the hair and
hair and the look and everything of that. But Sheridan, he has to take that badge off. He has to take his uniform off, get on the White Star with Delenn, fly out and fucking take these guys down. Stop Earth from having this ultimate weapon. A weapon, a ship that we have seen time and time again to be one of the most deadly things in this universe. But Sheridan's already taken one down already. Can he take another? And they throw the extra salt in the wound, the extra dramatic thing, which is, it's insane, Rachel. They put a person in, they weren't properly trained, and now it's just this reckless beast that's going around attacking. It isn't a normal a shadow ship.
It doesn't have the precision.
It's unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I was afraid of. The merging was not handled properly. The ship is out of control, insane. It will destroy anything in its path.
And we've got to stop it before anyone else gets here. Engines at maximum, standby. Weapon system, prepare to fire.
John, if it's confused, disoriented, we may have a chance. It's a small one,
It's still a lot more than an Earth cruiser will have against that thing.
The shadow ship flying into Jupiter and getting crushed inside of it. That's pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
That it looks like a spider when you crush it and how mm-hmm. it kind of crinkles up and stiffens and kind of squishes at the same time.
And the legs sort of going out mm-hmm. flat, but mm-hmm. then being distorted as mm-hmm. well. It's like, yeah, that's what happens when you hit a spider with a thong, right?
Yes, you know- yes. I know what you're talking about. Just when you smack them and they just go, whoop, there they go. And you just see the life leave them.
Splat.
And you see the life leave their body as their body contorts in these really limp but also stiff ways. Oh, they captured that really well. I did think it was pretty neat that the Agamemnon came back. And that was the ship that was hunting them down.
Of all the ships.
Of all the ships.
In all the galaxies. You had to.
Walk into mine. Yeah, yeah. I know JMS did a commentary track for this a little while back, and he said if he was writing this today, that's the thing he would change. It would just be any ship. It shouldn't have to be the Agamemnon for Sheridan to worry. I understand that point of view, but as a viewer, I have a sense of personal attachment because it is a ship we have met before.
Yes.
Not just it's Sheridan's ship. I have met the Agamemnon before. If it was, say, Captain Pierce's ship from season one, maybe I'd care too. Like, I'm trying to think of other
yeah.
Earth fighter ships that we've met, other destroyers and things of that nature, Hyperion classes. But it being the Agamemnon, yes, it's because of Sheridan's own personal connection. But me, the audience, I care too because I've met this and I've heard stories about it before.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful stories, like when Sheridan and Co. met these aliens and remember that?
Yeah.
And now he has to determine whether he shoots at them.
Yep. And that is not a line that he's willing to cross yet.
Yeah. Yeah. True growth of the character will be had where the tensions and the drama that Earth will bring will heighten to the point in which he will have to shoot and fire upon other Earth ships. But here, he isn't ready to do that. And it's good to see this be also one of the last times where that's like a major thing for him, because in the next few episodes, he's going to have to shoot on his own ships. He's going to have to use Babylon 5 to take these down. He's always going to be upset by it. That's what makes him a human character that we want to follow, a hero we want to follow, where he has remorse, he has guilt, he has complications with this, complicated feelings about this. But here, he's not willing to do that. So Delenn has to be the one to figure out how to win the day, which is good because we don't need it. We can't have it be Sheridan to win all the time. We need, the other characters in this ship to be functional. So we already have Linnea. He's great. He's making quips. He's pressing all the buttons in time and doing all the things and answering questions. But we need Delenn to serve a purpose in the big fight as well, other than just to say,
why is she here?
Other than to say they plug in human, they have organic things inside of them to operate. We need her to come up with the jump point with an atmosphere. A neat piece of lore. A neat piece of world building. Where
I also really like the moment where Sheridan's like, ladies and gentlemen. Oh no.
Minbari.
Wait, is that right?
Yeah, I guess you can't call them ladies and gentlemen. Sheridan, you got me, buddy. You got me there.
It's just like, no, I haven't really thought about Minbari genders.
I mean, I think they're that, but is it you still call them ladies and gentlemen? Who knows? They fly off home and things will never be the same again. We skipped past during the journey to Earth to Earth-controlled space. Is that the term that you like?
Yes.
We have a humanizing scene.
Oh my god, it's
scene.
So cute. I remember my heart aching as I watched this scene. I'm pretty sure after this scene finished, I made you pause it because I thought I was going to cry because I was shipping these two so fucking hard. And I finally got a moment of like just plain tenderness and calm between the two of them. And I'm like, that. Oh my god, this isn't just in my head. They do have feelings for each other. Please, please make this canon, please.
As a married couple, I want to ask you this, because when I watch moments like this, where they're courting each other, flirting, but they can't say it, they can't kiss, they can't do the, it's chaste romance. Do you miss that phase of our relationship, where she says something along, what really gets me is, if you fall, I shall catch you. This is just so, where it's like she's saying it in this way where it's just like, you know what I mean, but you also, you know, I'm saying it in the most plain way, but, you know, I'm here for you. Do you miss that phase of love where we had to be a bit more coy about things in this manner?
No, because we still have moments like that where we play it a bit more chaste. Or like a little more cute with the way that we do things that reminds me of the way that that used to be. But I think the main reason that I don't miss it is because in reality, it can also be very fucking awkward.
And stressful.
And stressful.
Because it's like, do they feel for me the way I feel for
but
them?
But now we get to have those cute moments. Knowing how we both feel and being very secure in that attachment and that knowledge.
I get annoyed by it in writing terms for the most part. Babylon 5 does it fairly well, and I love this scene. It's one of my favorite pieces of writing JMS has ever done. I liked that part of our of relationship. For me, it was fun. To be kind of flirty, but without actually saying it and without actually committing in that way that we do now, because there was always that sense of progress, but also danger to it in case maybe it doesn't work out. And then, you know, you pick yourself up. But I don't know. There's just something about even watching it here. It transports me back to those times where we would say these things and you know that there's another meaning to it underneath, but they're not actually saying it. I miss that a little bit in terms of how it is in your early stages, but now we know each other so well where we don't have to bandy about in the same way. And that's good too, but when you watch certain pieces of media, you're a big fan of romance novels and things, and you transport yourself to those for sure to capture something that isn't always as frequent in your own romantic relationships.
It does make me think back fondly to those moments that still stick out from that stage of our relationship, because now it's been so long, I only really remember the nice moments, especially with things like this, of like the cute little moments where it's just like, is this hug more than just a friend-style hug? Or if I put my hand here, how are they going to respond?
Is it just a holding of the hands, or is there something more happening? So the scene is Sheridan needs to go to sleep, and he has to fuck around with the Minbari bed because they have them on an angle, because having them flat is tempting death. And wouldn't you know it, Delenn's there too. And She's there to talk to him, comfort him, and to get to know him more. And we get a lovely story about Sheridan, how he's always had trouble getting to sleep. He is very much the type of person who will stay up late when something's stressing him out and struggles to sleep. But when it rains on the roof, that is what helps him. And he's missed that sensation because he is in space. He's on a space station. You can't get that anymore. And he talks about his father, who's a person we've heard about in the past. He's this person he admires, respects, and emulates in many ways. And we've never, we will soon, but we have not met his father, really. We had a weird flash of him in Knives, but yeah. That was like an alien thing. But we have never actually met his father, but we will soon. But we've heard some portions of him where you get a feeling of, oh, this is how Sheridan came to be. But this conversation, this backstory, this conversation about the rain on the roof and how his dad heard him walking about, grabbed the hose and sprayed it so that it would rain, and Sheridan thinks that he would have stayed there for days.
That's the line that really gets me.
Yeah. It just says a lot about the Sheridans and about how much they care for one another, the compassion and the warmth, and how much they're willing to go out of
their love for each other
with action.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And Bruce Boxleitner gives a wonderful performance. He's smiling. He's quiet. He pauses in the right amount. You can see him reflecting back on this. There's even a moments of sorrow because this was a portion of his life that's no longer around. He no longer lives with his dad, and he misses his dad. That's what gives me that line, when he just quietly says to himself that he misses him. And now he has to, you know, there's many meanings to that because he's flying to Earth. He's flying to Earth-controlled space. He's going to be close to him, but he's not going to be able to see him. And yeah, I just, This is an emotional scene for me. It just touches my heart in all the right ways. It's played well. The acting between the two of them is great, but it feels a piece to the character of Sheridan. If there was any doubt to me of if Sheridan's a character I would like, this would have put it to rest. It is such a well-articulated moment for him. It gives me everything I need of Sheridan, everything I need to root for the guy. And this is written by one person. And this is clearly something that they've taken from themselves and put into their script. It is too specific. And maybe it isn't. Maybe this is just something he made up for the character. But there are certain things I do know about JMS which ring true to this, like he's a night owl and everything, but there's just something about this whole the rain on the roof, and then obviously she plays rain on the ship's computer, that nice, again, it's nice.
My dad heard me walking around. He knew I couldn't sleep. So he went outside. He got the garden hose and sprayed it so it came down on the roof. Just like rain. He stood there making it rain until I fell asleep. I sometimes think he would have stood there for days if he had to. I miss him.
Just want to give a quick shout out to the music in this episode. Fantastic.
Perfect.
I was worried at first because there were some musical stings at the beginning that I wasn't a fan of. The Marcus fight scene sounded like a video game.
It goes for it.
And when they cut to Ivanova on the bridge looking nervous, and they cut to the Franklin looking over Dr. Kirkish, there's this music, this kind of tick-tocking sound that I wasn't huge in. But then, after that, jeez, they just went off the chain. Again, they just went out of their way to make sure that this episode kicked ass. Because this is epic. You've got these chanting, these warbling sounds, this electric guitar. a cacophony of noises, but it's all so beautiful. It does add a sense of weight and epicness to the entire affair. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
Was there a particular standout moment for you when it comes to the music and how it aided scenes, or just a musical piece that you remember?
I really like the score and the Jakar scene.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just softly there, but...
not intrusive.
Yeah. Just supporting the scene. And... it's a bit stupid, but I really like the... throughout the scene with Marcus and Ivanova at the end when he comes in with the chart and how it sort of transitions when they're watching ISN declare martial law.
Yes, it's very, oh, isn't this cute and fun? Aren't we having a fun old time? Look at this. They're a nice romantic couple to dramatic dread. It bleeds into that very nicely, not too choppy. To talk about martial law is declared at the end of this, and that is really when you know shit is going to get real bad now. Wow, the actions that our heroes have taken have allowed Clark to enact this, to justifiably enact this terrible thing upon the people. And most likely... it will come to Babylon 5 sooner rather than later. We have the Night Watch during all of this. All of this stuff is happening, and we keep having these scenes cut back to Zack. We keep cutting to Zack having to deal with the Night Watch, in which he is frustrated with them.
Yep.
Not only because they have multiple meetings now a week.
It's like, oh, this was meant to be easy credits that I didn't have to work for. I was just meant to have to wear an armband.
And do my job.
And do my job.
But now my job is also this job. Now I've got two jobs. And one of them's a scary fascist group. And there's this creepy guy, this creepy tall blonde-haired man, who comes into my little office, and he's very frightening. And he is compelling as well, though, because the back and forth between this nameless security guard, who's going to be very important in the next episode as well, is he is enforcing Night Watch beliefs upon Zack, and does so in a very off-putting manner. But for someone like Zack, he's being guilted into it as well, because the guy is saying, well, what are you going to do? Choose between your friends who could be undermining the government, or you're going to choose between that or your job, which is to, you know, look after Earth? You know, the thing that you're supposed to be doing, Zack? And Zack's just flabbergasted by it all, and you have... the moment with that security guard. Do we want to talk about it? We've already joked about it at the very beginning.
Fuck. It's so insidious. I love it. It's so disgusting. So security guard number one pops in and is like, hey, Zack, letting you know we have another meeting. Complains about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he doesn't leave it there.
Oh, no, before he leaves,
he
just add a little twist.
He takes it to a fucking weird place.
Mm-hmm.
And he does it with one line. And what line is that, Ryan?
You know, sometimes watching them like this, without them even knowing we're here, makes you feel a little like God, doesn't it?
That statement is fucking terrifying. And I'm just going to be real honest with you. We've known some people who have worked in security.
Mm-hmm.
I have some relatives who are cops. And they've just casually said statements like that at me.
Yeah.
And it's really unnerving. And I don't like it. And this
scene... you get
scene,
why, but you're like, no, I don't want that. I don't want that.
Yeah, this scene gets under my skin a lot. And the guy who plays him does a marvelous job of being this piece of shit. Because you get him later where he's doing the meeting and he's dispensing the information. Hey, I'm the Night Watch liaison. Here's what's going on. And he's so fucking happy. He's saying these things that are bad, but he's so happy to say them, though, because now it gives us the opportunity to be the bad boys, to enact arrests on these scum. But the information he's supposed to be giving is supposed to be somber and sad, like, guys, I'm so sorry to tell you this, but Earth has been infiltrated from within. But he's saying it like, guys, they've got us at every level, but don't you worry. We have been given the authority to arrest people and to have witnesses and look into people's history. And he's just salivating. He's just salivating at this. And every time...
He's so attracted to the power that is being offered up to him.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way that I take it.
And we talked about with Julie Mesanti as a great Earth villain, in terms of we've seen her type a lot, specifically in politics and media, like news. But his brand of evil, that thug, that cop,
mm-hmm.
who is now allowed to enact violence or enact horror upon people because he's been given the authority to do so.
Yeah.
Well, we've seen that a lot, haven't we? We've seen that a lot and a lot and a lot and a lot. And he is just one of those characters where you go, will this ever change? Will this ever change?
I don't think so.
We'll always have guys like this.
Yeah,
huh?
I think.
And they'll always find their way into positions where they are allowed to do this, right?
Drumhead.
Yeah, it's a drumhead. Yeah.
Like, I think Picard's speech at the end of Drumhead is absolutely right.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. But to go back with B5, though, it's one of those things where it goes, geez, even in the future we can't get rid of this?
Yeah.
In the future we can't get rid of this type of cop? And Zach is uncomfortable with it. What did you think about Zach throughout this all? Because he's swaying back and forth between the good side and the dark side.
I love it. His morality is not just hanging in the balance, but it's swinging. And we really hope that Zach is going to be on the right side, but we also know the danger of somebody who's feeling like they're being left out and they're not on the inside.
And he has the ability to take down Garibaldi, at least, which is why he's so apprehensive, because Garibaldi is still his friend. He still looks at Garibaldi as his friend. He knows that Garibaldi doesn't trust him, but he still sees a connection between the two of them, so he's not willing to rat him out. But it's not just that, is it? We know it's not just that. It is because Zach does find the Night Watch reprehensible, but he doesn't know what to do about it. He's cornered in. Because,
and he also doesn't see himself as having any power over the situation.
Yeah.
To go back to like that scene a while back now, I think, of I'm glad that I don't have to make that sort of decision. That's not up to me.
And he has experienced firsthand, especially here, that the tactic that he and Via are very good at using, which is, well, if I voice my concern, that means I've done my part. Surely that means things will be fine now. If I say, hey, isn't that wrong? Or, hey, we shouldn't do that. That means that things are fine. No, Zach. You just saying out loud,
it is not
enough, isn't
enough to just call out injustice.
You need to actually take action. And he will in the next episode.
And Via
also does throughout the show. But that's what I really appreciate about B5. It doesn't just pat Zach on the back for saying out loud that the things are bad. It in fact really smacks him on the back of the head for doing that, saying, no, Zach, that's not good enough. Look at you. Look where you are, Zach. here's what's happening. You keep doing this. I'm going to keep smacking you harder and harder. And this is where we're at, where the smack I'm giving you is this guy coming in saying, don't you feel like God? And then not only the guy with the godlike, like perception of being godlike, he's now got the authority from the government to do reprehensible shit. And you are just sitting there watching that happen, Zach. Not good enough.
You have to actively fight against injustice in the world.
Well, ever since I joined up with you guys, he doesn't trust me like he used to. If he could trust me, he would have brought me into this thing weeks ago.
So you admit something's going on. You've been seeing the same things I have.
I didn't say that! Look, things are a little tough between us right now, but he's still a friend.
Well, you better start deciding which is more important to you, Zach. Friendship or your job, which is to protect Earth. If you figure that out, you let me know.
We're at that part of the show, Rachel, where we shine a spotlight on an actor or actress that appeared here in a big or small role. And we like to look over how they were in the episode, what else we know them from, any interesting pieces of trivia. And for this one, we're deciding to talk about, security guard number one. Isn't that right?
Yeah, played by Vaughn Armstrong.
Vaughn Armstrong, who will be in the next episode, but there's a guest star on that we'll most likely want to talk about. So I don't want to skip over talking about Vaughn Armstrong, because to me, he is possibly one of my favorite minor guest spots in Babylon 5. I cannot say enough how much I love his performance as this character, this unnamed foe, in this episode and in the next one. He just makes me so uncomfortable. And his character isn't an elegant villain. He is a brute force, no-nonsense, piece-of-shit cop. And usually, and if you listen to this podcast, you know, usually these aren't the type of villains that I'm drawn to. I'm more drawn to your Julie Masantes, your Mr. Wells, your Mr. Morden, and all of that, where they're the more elegant, I'm in a position of power, and I'm a manipulator, and I'm ever so smug type. This guy, though, he's just a cop with an armband, a gun, and the authority to do horrendous actions. And Vaughn Armstrong's performance is a real major factor into why he goes over the hurdle of the villain to the type I like. Because again, this isn't usually the type of villain I'm drawn to, but he makes me sweat every time. Just a nervous sweat on the brow forms when he comes on screen. Just seeing this guy just irks me, just makes me want to leave the room.
He's a skin crawler. Like, he just makes your skin crawl and you feel gross looking at him.
Yes. Yes. So, what do you think about Vaughn Armstrong's performance here and his character overall?
He does it really well. He makes me hate him instantly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, yeah. You make this work for you, buddy.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So, many people know Vaughn Armstrong for his many roles. Many, many, many roles.
Currently 102 credits on IMDb.
Oh, I was just going to say in Star Trek. Like, what, he has like 50 characters he does in Star Trek? He has so many characters in Star Trek that there are ones that I didn't even realize that was him. He plays humans. He plays a variety of aliens. He's Admiral Forrest in Enterprise, which is probably the one I remember, maybe because that's the most frequent one, and it's also it's just him. And I've even heard people over the years say that he should have played Captain Archer. Like, he's that type of actor. That type of energy he brings would have been suited to play Archer more than Scott Bakula. And I can't argue with that. I'm not a huge Enterprise fan, so I may be speaking a little bit ill there, but I'm not a huge Archer fan. I know that for sure. Even though I'm a Bakula fan, not a huge fan of Archer. So Forrest is one of those human admirals that is well-regarded because he appears a lot. He isn't a strict, like, mustache-twirly evil admiral type that we get so often. There's more to him. Vaughn Armstrong does a good job there. I mean, in Voyager, I think I read he played 5 different characters in Voyager alone. I know he played a Vidian, which are those creeps with the, like, the phage disease where they're just organ harvesting.
5.
Yeah, 5?
He has 5 roles in Voyager, and I think it's, like, 3 or 4 in Next Gen.
Mm-hmm. And I think he has like 3 or 4 in Enterprise and some more in Deep Space Nine. So what did you find on your journey through Vaughn Armstrong's career? And also, I guess, before that, do you remember him in any specific Star Trek role? Anyone in leaping out to you?
Nope.
No?
No. I just like, I know his face.
Mm-hmm.
But I cannot remember all of the things that he's done in Star Trek.
I saw you. You were scrolling through some of his Star Trek roles and you just were going, oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That one and that one and, oh, that one too. Okay. So I was scrolling through and he really is a bit part TV actor. And that seems to have been his whole career. His first credit was in 1977. So he's been doing this a while, and his latest credit was 2020.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if he's finished up TV acting or if he's just on a little bit of a break. I mean, pandemic times make it a bit harder to do acting. So
none of his particular roles jumped out at me, but I was like looking at all the shows and being like, oh yeah, of course this guy was in Seinfeld.
Everyone's in Seinfeld.
Of course everyone was. Of course he was also in a random episode of NYPD Blue.
Everybody's in NYPD Blue. Was he in Hill Street Blues though? That's the question.
Oh, I didn't see it, but it doesn't mean that it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
He was in an episode of Desperate Housewives.
Yes.
Did you see what his character name was? Do you remember?
A weird character name. I cannot remember. Oh, a Civil War major. So, yeah, he plays a lot of cops, a lot of generals, a lot of military figures. He has that face for it, doesn't he?
He worked with Bakula on Quantum Leap.
Yes. Do you want to say who he was in Quantum Leap?
No, you can.
He was Trump's dad in the infamous Christmas episode of Quantum Leap where Scott Bakula's Sam Beckett accidentally inspired Donald Trump to become more of a tyrant than he already was, even as a little boy. He plays Trump's dad, who was Fred Trump. I want to say that I can't remember Trump's dad. Yeah, Fred Trump. He played Fred Trump. I don't want to go past this because I know our listeners out there, our younglings, Pat and Nick, are huge fans of some Bruce Campbell work out there. He was a major. I know you're shocked to hear that, Rachel. He was a major in The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. So that is something to note down. He was also a bit part or minor parts in some movies, Clear and Present Danger. He was in the Philadelphia Experiment. I do like that when I looked over his IMDb trivia, it pointed out that his father was a huge Star Trek fan. And knowing that, it kind of makes sense why him and as an actor gunned to be in Star Trek so much. It's one of those things where I don't know the exact details of that, but hearing just that loose piece of trivia, it kind of adds up to why he's in so much.
I also want to note, like, you know, as actors do, and Babylon 5 has a track record of pulling actors from these particular genres, even this specific show, as guest stars and them doing a kick-ass job.
Yeah.
He was in Days of Our Lives. He's been in Days of Our Lives as 4 separate characters appearing over different decades,
and
from what I could gather from IMDb.
And I do want to point out, he was in Jake and the Fat Man, which is a show that JMS had previously worked on, and he was in Scarecrow and Mrs. King, which is the show that Bruce Boxleitner was in as well. That was a big deal for him. So he's interacted with some works and even some people directly that have been in this show already. So that's some interesting connections there that I've been stumbling across. Overall, a really fascinating figure because, as you said, he's always a bit part player, but in even the things that I do remember him in, like, again, he's in things that I've seen, but I may not remember him in, but in most of the things that I have seen and do remember, he's very good. Here, he's in two episodes of Babylon 5, and he's one of my favorite villains that we ever had in it, and he does nothing.
He just is evil.
He just is a garbage human, and I adore him, and so many Star Trek characters, and I was looking through, it's like, oh yeah, I remember him, this. He's just a very standout presence, even though he never has settled on a major ongoing role. Even in all those Star Trek shows, Admiral Forrest is the one that's really the most recurring character. The others are all one and dones, or maybe a couple here, a couple there. There are just some of these actors that we go through in our journey of the spotlight where you go, they were really comfortable just living episode to episode on random show to show, rather than, say, being a part of an ensemble or being a returning guest star over and over again, which, as an actor myself, I find that interesting. And I would love to talk to actors of this caliber, of this nature, of what it is like to live in that sphere. Because I know many actors want to have, say, if they're in TV, want to be not just even a lead, but say you're like Via in this show. You just have a steady job in a TV show.
Steady paycheck.
Steady paycheck, a character that you're part of, a production you're a part of. But then you get many people like Vaughn here where, nope, I'm on to the next show and on to the next project. I'm doing a movie, I'm doing a play, I'm doing this one episode of Seinfeld, I'm here, over there. Because to me, that is really cool because there's a wealth of stories to be had there. But yeah, I wonder what it is like, how much of a challenge that can be as an actor.
Earth needs all the information we can give her. Any source is acceptable. To make it easier for sources to come forward, we're going to allow them to give us information anonymously. We're authorized to look into past history, social contacts, party affiliations, to conduct email and vid surveillance of Babcom and Stellarcom transmissions.
Wait. Just how far does this go, anyway? Do we start suspecting everybody?
No, of course not. Anyone in the Night Watch is automatically recognized as working in the best interests of Earth. As for the other officers, well, we won't look at them unless we detect any unusual activity on their part.
What are we going to rate this on our impervious scale of yum being bad and yum yum being good? Rachel, do we give any half yums?
No.
We don't go, oh, this is a half yum, it's so bad. We don't do that. Or we go, this is a yum and a half because it's somewhat, no. We only give yum being bad, yum yum being good. It's a real black and white system here. There's no shades of grey. I give this, to no one's shock, a yum yum.
Yum yum.
It's a yum yum from me too.
Yum yum.
Let's hear what we'll be talking about next time on Babylon 5.
On an all-new Babylon 5.
Episode 9. And the name of the season, because it's written on the DVD, so you know it's important, Rachel. Point of No Return. The DVD describes this monumental episode as such. The iron grip of martial law that holds Earth is extended to the station and enforced by Night Watch officers. But Sheridan remains defiant and comes up with a plan to oust Night Watch. Oh. let's end this episode right now so that we can get closer to doing that episode. You can find us on your social medias of choice under Yum Yum Pod or Yum Yum Podcast. Rachel, we have an email as well. Do you want to tell people about that?
It's yumyumpod@gmail.com. And if you want even more content from us, we also have a Patreon where you can check out loads of episodes that we've done just for our patrons, which, you know,
you can be a part of.
Backlog.
There's a huge backlog. We've covered Strange New Worlds. We've covered second season of Picard. We are, as we speak, going episode by episode through Space Above and Beyond. Rachel's never seen it before. I have. So if you want to join us along our Space Above and Beyond journey, come on over there. If you haven't seen the show in its entirety before, don't worry. We're not spoiling it outside of the individual episodes. So come on over to our Patreon. We have a group Discord where we can chat and share things and have a jolly old time and watch things on there. It's really cool. We've got a great community happening and a huge backlog. So Yum Yum Podcast on Patreon. All of this is in the description of the episode. Jakar did turn up. He was feeling a little too enlightened today. A little too spiritual. But I did see him write a Naan, because I can read Naan, because I'm that skilled. I saw he wrote in his holy book of Jakar, good eating to you.
Well, good eating to you as well, right?
Good eating to you, Rachel.
Ah, Mr. Cannibal! Hey!